the Empire podcast this week, we are packing our t-shirts, our diaries, and our bloodstain remover because we're headed to Camp Miasma to talk with director Jen Schoenbrunn. All this and the usual movie news and reviews on the movie podcast that can now exclusively announce that we are responsible for the wigs on the Beatles movies. And they're eco-friendly. Yes, I'm excited to say that we have finally found a way to reuse all the sweepings from the floor of our local hairdresser by sticking them into the faces of talented young British and Irish actors. What a time to be alive. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Your usual host, Chris Hewitt, is obviously not here. He is away on holiday this week. For once, he's not even on a film set.
Sorry, a what?
Holiday?
And what is that?
It's what you had the last couple
of years. Oh, yes, that's right. I forgot.
Anyway, fear not, because while he probably golfs, I am joined, as you heard, by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, in this, the week that the MCU has announced the first of their brand new X-Men, we have our very own Beast. He's hairy, he's knowledgeable, he's Jamie Graham.
Hello, Helen, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm glad you call me a beast. I take that as a compliment.
You are quite Beatles adjacent.
I am. I'm getting more and more hairy. Every time you see me, the beard's getting bigger and greyer, I'm sorry to say, and the hair's getting bigger, so I don't know where it's going to stop.
I mean, look, it's just jealousy, really, from me. So, yeah.
Well, I don't want to say anything. Yeah.
Well, yes, you've heard him already, but joining us is a man who never met a supervillain he doesn't love. Meet the mad titan of movies, our very own Mr. Sinister, James Dyer.
Oh,
how you doing?
Thank you. I don't think I could do it. I think Adam Driver will make a much better Mr. Sinister than I possibly would. But I like to think that old Nathaniel was misunderstood.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
You'd like to think that about all of them.
I do. I like to see the best in people, Helen. Mm-hmm. I like to see the best in people.
I mean, I'm all for that, but also not for mass murder. Call me an old funny-duddy.
I mean, murder. You say murder.
Oh, boy. Well, yes, just for those keeping score at home, yes, it does mean that we are now like late-night TV shows. We now have more white men called James than we have women. So good job, everybody. And before we get into the podcast proper, I do want to remind you of something that Chris has honestly kept forgetting every time we've recorded for the last several weeks and adding in at the last minute. We are going to be live at the London Podcast Festival. Yes, James, you should have this in your diary.
I mean,
everyone should have it in their diary. Everybody get out your diary right now. September 5th, King's Place in London. We are going to be live there at our spiritual home. We will have news. We will have reviews. We will hopefully have spot prizes and an amazing guest. Honestly, Chris hasn't told me, but I'm pretty sure that he's attempting to have both.
Okay, well, this sounds very positive, and I shall check my schedule and speak to my people and see if I'm able to attend.
Good Lord. You don't have a choice about this, by the way. You are going to be coming.
Okay.
There are some tickets left, I believe, so please do join us if you haven't booked your ticket already. You can look at kingsplace.co.uk and then just search for the Empire Podcast or go down the calendar to September 5th, where you will find us in what we are pleased to call the headliner slot. Whether that is accurate or not, I do not know.
Of course it is.
All right, so enough shameless plugging for now. It is time for a question, and we have a few contenders this week. So let's see how we respond to some of these.
Okay.
First up, from Instagram, Daniel Watkins asks, if the Empire Pod booth got end of Oak Streeted to another time, when would you like to end up? So those of you who haven't seen End of Oak Street yet, first of all, it's a good film, go see it. But second of all, it's basically a neighborhood that gets dropped into the time of the dinosaurs. And suddenly these suburban 1980s families have to figure out a way to survive, T-Rexes and all sorts. I would not like to go there. What with all the T-Rexes and all sorts?
That's quite a big window. When you said the time of the dinosaurs,
yes.
It's a very vague, it's several million years.
If Steven Spielberg can be vague about when Jurassic is, I can be vague about the time of the dinosaurs.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so I'm saying not that. I'm saying no thank you to that. I will be honest, I do like toilets and stuff, so like that does really limit me in time. I think, you know,
Helen's a big fan of toilets.
I get you.
Love them. Can't get enough of them.
Hygiene, water, safety.
The thing is, Helen, I think you're missing the point of the end of Oak Street, which is the whole point is that they're taken to an era that they 100% don't want to be. So surely, if we were to really embrace the spirit of that film, it'd be what is the era you really don't want to get transported back to and then would have to deal with it?
Okay.
That's true. That wasn't the question, though, James.
It wasn't,
to be
no.
Fair.
I'm
in
a maverick.
His head it is. Mm. Yeah.
You are a maverick.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do both.
Maybe
well,
we can.
I'm a woman, so most of history is going to be pretty
oh,
bad.
You're fucked. Yeah,
yeah. It's, yeah. Not, it's not great. How about you guys?
You go first.
Good God. When would I like to and when would I not like to? I mean, not like to, I'm going to say the 1970s, because I just don't have the build for flares. I can't pull them off. I would look ridiculous. And I just, and also autumnal, kind of those kind of russety tones, browns,
well, you're
oranges.
More of a winter, I've
right.
always said.
This is what I'm saying. I don't think I could pull off the fashion choices. Plus, I have no hair. So, you know, I wouldn't be able to even have one of those glorious, great big mops.
Big wig.
Could have a big wig. That is an option. That's a last resort if it actually if it comes to that. So I don't think I would do well in the 70s. I always like, I'm a big fan of fantasy. I love Game of Thrones. So part of me's like, oh, I'd love to go back to medieval England, except of course I 100% wouldn't.
No.
Because it's like the worst time in history. So while I would quite like some of the aesthetics, like the heraldry and the banners and the castles and the knights and the horses, I think I'd have a pretty poor time of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like people throwing sewage on my head as I walk down the street,
exactly.
That kind of stuff.
That's not a good look.
No.
It's
no.
not good. I am really, really safe. I'm so nostalgic that I would just go back to the 1980s. You ask any of my friends, all I ever talk about is my childhood and my teenage years. So I'd go back to the 1980s, I'd go back to school, I'd revisit all those days. And of course, my favourite film, Stand By Me, was filmed in the summer of 1985. So I'd hop over to Oregon, I'd go up the train tracks with the boys,
when's
I'd be on set.
When's it set, though?
Well, it's set in 1959,
right, so
isn't
surely
it?
The 50s are where you want to end up.
I could do the 50s. I could easily also, because Christine's one of my favourite films and she only plays 50 songs on her. So I would be very, very happy with a jukebox in the 1950s. Yeah, that's a good point.
The 80s are a good shout, though. I was having a chat with my cousin, his girlfriend, who is in her, what, sort of early to mid-20s. So this was quite an enlightened view of her. She believes that human civilization peaked.
100%.
In the mid-90s.
No. Yeah,
right.
Maybe.
Because obviously the 80s were great.
Yeah, it was leading up.
Yeah, yeah. But then I think the 90s, because 90s were very much my era, sort of from a musical point of view. And I think also in the 90s, you were looking fondly back on the 80s. You were still in the glow of the 80s. But crucially, it was before the internet came along and ruined everything.
That is very true. And you had a lot more hope in the 90s.
You did. But as in we had some.
Living in Britain, it felt like we were going someplace. You know? We were doing something.
Right, because living in Britain, there wasn't a lot of hope in the 80s.
Yeah.
In some regards. So we had some in the 90s. And yes, I do know the internet did exist in the 90s, but in reality, it was dial-up and nobody was on it. So
it wasn't quite so toxic. That's,
right.
That's fair. I have some notes about the 90s. I feel like in some ways we could have been more enlightened in the 90s.
I mean, this
could.
Is true.
We
this
could.
Is true. Yes.
But yes, I take where you're coming from. I don't know that there's a good time. I will say there's a great series of books by Julian May that I mention quite a lot.
The Many-Coloured Land.
The Many-Coloured Land, The Saga of the Exiles. And she basically says that 6 million years ago was a pretty good time to be around.
Okay.
Now, was this the age of the dinosaurs, Helen?
No, it was after the dinosaurs. We're post-dinosaurs. We are post-Ice Age or between Ice Ages. We've got a balmy sort of climate in Europe. It's just quite gentle. There aren't a lot of huge predators trying to kill you. It's just kind of chill. So that might be my answer.
That's good. But there's no movies.
No, there aren't any movies.
I couldn't live. So that I have to be like 1895 onwards. I couldn't go pre-movies. I couldn't exist.
Oh, you know, they had like, what, shadow puppets?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, erotic stories.
Well, 6 million years ago, there's no evidence of that. But yes, sure.
I refuse to believe people didn't do the little bunny ears on the cave wall, even back then. And you best believe they had erotic stories.
They did. They did.
Wow. A lot of grunts, as we know, from any caveman film.
I have no follow-up questions to that whatsoever. Please stop. Okay. Well, there you have a wildly unsatisfying selection of answers. That does kind of lead me on to one of the other questions I got. Vigo, the sorrow of Moldavia on Discord,
Scourge of Carpathia,
has asked, as film journalists, do you maintain a personal top 3, 5, 10, or 20? Now, my answer is immediately, no, I do not. I can pull one out of my arse when called upon to do so, but I absolutely do not have a top anything because I do not believe in ranking things. However, I suspect others in this room may disagree.
Now, Jamie, I'm absolutely certain that you have a curated list and I'm prepared to bet that it's not just a top 10. I reckon you've got at least a top 50 and maybe even a top 100.
I've got a top 10, 50, 100 of everything. I'm so sad. I just go off the charts on this. I have it for, if you want to do films of the year so far, I keep that running as I go. So I have that on my phone. I've got my top 100. I've got my top 1,000 films. I've got my top 100 horror films. I've got my top 100 film noirs. I've got everything. So you could even go years. You could chuck a year at me and go 1976, and I'll go on to my letterbox and I'll have my top 20 films of 1976. I literally sit at home watching TV, and whenever I get a bit bored or I haven't got anything to do or whatever I'm watching is really shit, I go, I know, I'm going to do a top 10, like, stepmom films or something. I've got everything. I'm really, really, really sad. And I think it's all about trying to get some sort of order in my life. If we're going to go deep and psychological, I feel so sort of messy as a person and disorganized. This is the one place in life I can put some tram lines in.
Do you know, it's funny. So I want to know how this particular thing affects you. Because one of the things, you talk about civilization peaking in the 90s. One of the things that I lament as we moved into the 21st century was the decline, and now, you know, much more so, of physical media. Yeah. And one of the reasons for that is, it's in some circles, it's possibly, or has historically been, quite a male thing to do, to define yourself by the things you love. Mm-hmm. So your entire identity is, I am these things that I love.
Yeah.
And so all of us growing up, and I'm sure you did it as well, Helen, like, we would have our displays of our VHS boxes, and we'd have them in a very specific, and so we wouldn't have art on the walls, we had films. And maybe we had our posters from films, whatnot, but all of these things were our identity writ large on the walls of our room, and then as we got older, you know, flat house, whatever. And I think nowadays, the alternative, like, what have you got? So I think nowadays what you have is Spotify playlists, you have Letterboxd accounts, you have virtual bedrooms where you can put out your shelves of VHS tapes for other people to see who you are by what you like.
Yeah.
Funko Pops.
I remember the first day I went to university, I had to share a room with two other guys in my first year, which I was dreading. And I turned up and they were complete opposite of me. I was a heavy metaller, thrash metal, long hair, much as I look today, actually. And they were very much kind of, you know, into Oasis and a bit of U2 and stuff like that. And the first thing we did was sit down, compare our record collection, our tape collections we'd brought to uni, and our box of VHS videos that we'd brought. And literally within 10 minutes, we kind of felt we knew each other. We had
common ground.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, oh yeah, that's the one area of crossover.
Was it the Shawshank Redemption?
It wasn't actually, Helen, because I'm so old. It was before that. It was 1991. They had a lot of U2 and stuff. I was kind of a bit of an outlier. I was going with Danzig, Slayer, Prong.
Oh, proper.
And they were going like, what the fuck? I've never even heard of these bands. So, of course, I spent the next year introducing them.
Of course you did. God. And that was part of the fun, was converting people to your little cult of entertainment.
I did get them into Metallica. Into Metallica.
My next door neighbour in second year of university woke up every morning and played Enter Sandman.
Yes.
And that is a great way to wake up in the morning.
It's a nice way.
I mean, it's probably a better way to go to sleep, given that that's the theme of the song. But
you'd think, but it's a little much
more,
to go to sleep.
It's more Exit Sandman is kind of what's happening in the morning.
Yeah. So, okay. So do you keep a top 10, James?
Do you know what? It's funny.
Aliens, obviously.
Yes. As a film critic on dating apps, the question I get asked most in my life is, what are your top 10 films? And I don't have a top 10 films, which is a really awful response to have. But I have a favorite film, which is Aliens. Mm. And then I have a kind of rotating list of things I would lay down on railway tracks for. But I don't order them specifically. And they are, like, you know, Star Wars. They are
Die Hard,
Predator, all of the usual suspects, including the usual suspects. you know, all of these great films. But I couldn't give you a canonical ordering.
Right.
Because I love them all equally. Mm. I love Aliens first and foremost. That is my first love, my primary partner, if you will. And my secondary partners, to push this polyamorous metaphor, are all of these areas. Leon, Interview with the Vampire, all of these things. And as I always try and explain to people in an incredibly tedious way, which gives you an insight into my dating life, it's like, I'm not saying these are the best films. I'm not even saying they're the best films I've seen. I've definitely seen better films. But you see these things at pivotal junctures in your emotional development, and they become a part of your soul. And so it doesn't matter that Interview with the Vampire is a very flawed film. When I saw it, it had such an impact on me that it will forever be one of my favourite films. And, you know, Predator, like, to be fair, no, Predator is actually a stone cold masterpiece.
Predator is actually perfect.
But there are films on my list, like Nuns on the Run, which is objectively terrible, but it doesn't matter because I saw it at university and I remember what I was doing and who I was with. And so I absolutely adore it. And I think by the time you reach, let's say 25...
It changes.
I think by the time you reach, you know, your 20s, you love everything you're ever going to love, yeah, to a certain extent, because you've already developed, and so nothing else can be interwoven into your genetic makeup at that point because you are a fully formed human being.
Mm. Your brain opens up, doesn't it, as a teenager?
Yeah. It lets things in.
I mean, it's part of the whole reason why, you know, we exist and how we develop as human beings, and it is scientifically proven. It opens up, and I firmly believe that the stuff that really imprints on you, that you watch again and again or listen to again and again, that means everything to you,
yeah,
is, you know, stuff that comes into your life between maybe the ages of 14, 19, 21. It's those ages. That's when I used to discover a film and just watch it on loop. I'd, you know, something like RoboCop, I'd just watch again and again, yeah, and again. Now I will see a new film that I love, like the latest PTA or something, and I'll love it. But at the most, I'll watch it four or five times over a few, yeah, years. You just don't do it. Like, as a kid, I just watch things again and again.
But then the distinction also is, as we've already discussed, this is when human society peaked, but there wasn't a lot of entertainment, so... If you had a film, you would watch that film to death. So when I used to hire out a physical video from the local video store, I would watch it in the evening, then I would watch it again in the morning before I gave the tape
back. Get your money's worth.
Get your money's worth. So at the very minimum, you were doing that on a rental. And if I owned a tape, I'd get 20, 30, 40, 50 viewings out of it.
Exactly.
Because there wasn't a lot competing.
Can I just say as well, to go back to one of your earlier points about how you don't actually rank your top 10, that is the beauty of it, how fucking hard it is.
Impossible.
This morning, my wife actually said to me, this is honest truth, she said to me, like, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre in your top 5 films? It is, isn't it? And I said straight, I didn't even have to think about it. I said, well, the thing is, Tams, and it's so hard because it's either number 5 or number 6. And I named the 4 above it. And I said, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Taxi Driver, I just cannot split. They like swap 5 and 6, 5 and 6. They're always 5 and 6, but which one? And then she put me on the spot and she said, no, right now you have to mention it. You know, what is it? And I said, okay, it's Texas Chainsaw, it's number 5. But it's so hard to do, but you have to do it.
You
absolutely
don't have to do it.
Helen's egalitarian.
No, that's how I woke up this morning.
Free yourself from these shackles.
The tyranny of lists.
It was 7:30 in the morning and I was like so up. You know, I just like, had to get there.
It absolutely don't.
You do.
You really don't. I promise you.
Okay.
Nothing bad will happen.
All right.
But this is one of the joys of working at Empire, is whenever we have to do a big list, which normally happens online these days, the arguments we will have are extraordinary, where Ben Travis will take his latest terrible opinion and absolutely go to the mattresses over some dreadful film like The Rise of Skywalker, and we'll have a 45-minute digression deciding whether or not it's here or it's there on this. Yeah. But that's the joy, and we've kind of always done that.
But that's a different thing.
Yes.
That's having a nice argument, and you know I like having a nice argument.
Do you?
But I don't particularly want to sit and have a big argument with myself all day.
No, that's fair. Oh, I can only imagine.
For that.
That would be exhausting, Ellen.
It's fun, Ellen. I cannot see anyone all day and still go to bed exhausted.
But the first rule of anything is don't argue with Helen. So if Helen's arguing with herself, she has a problem.
I would never dare.
Yeah, it would be messy. All right, one more quick question before we go. This comes from Lizzie Bowley on Instagram as well. What are the top film locations that you have visited, and what else is still on your list to do? Now, I have a lot that I visited and just gotten a real kick out of. And one of the weird little ones is the beach with the rock on it from Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves.
You walked over the rock, right?
I walked over the rock. It's near my house, but I had to go searching for the exact spot, and then we found the exact rock.
Amazing.
And that felt like a process of discovery a little bit, you know, because I kind of just had to figure out exactly which corner we turned around on the beach. That was a good one. Things like going to Haddon Hall, which is where they shot a lot of The Princess Bride, which is one of my top films. Very exciting. What is on my list, one of them is the hotel in San Diego where they shot Some Like It Hot. which I was all set to go to one year at Comic-Con, and then Chris bloody Hewitt needed a lift and we had to leave early and I didn't have time to go. Still bitter. And also, I'm going to New Zealand next year, not entirely, but mostly to go to Lord of the Rings locations. And I'm very
hyped. That would
be
amazing.
I've done a lot of those. I did the Tongariro crossing. I saw Mount Doom. I did all sorts of things.
I'm very excited. The only sad part is we physically, we're in a camper van, so we physically cannot go to Mount Sunday, aka Edoras, which is, I'm gutted about actually. I'm really upset about. But there's no, you cannot drive a camper van because it's unsealed roads and you're literally not allowed.
One doesn't simply drive into Edoras.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my problem. So, hey-ho. How about you guys? Have you been to any exciting film locations?
I haven't. Off the top of my head, I haven't done a lot. I used to live near the flat in Trainspotting when they go to London towards the end of a film. It was just around the corner from me, so I used to walk past that every day. Mm. I've been to various locations that I can't even think about now. I've definitely done a few, but what I would like to do, I'm going to go back to Stand By Me, is I'd very much like to go. You can actually do a bit of a tour, like the train trestle is no longer there, but you can go to some of the locations, and the town where they sort of begin the film and end the film is Brownsville in Oregon, and apparently it hasn't changed at all. It's exactly like it was in the 50s and when they filmed it, and you can go there and you can go around the various places and do the little walk and across the bridge when they come back after Labor Day and stuff like that. So I'd love to do that, and I did almost do it a few years ago. My wife planned it all out for me, and then at the last second I bottled it and decided I couldn't afford it. But no. I really wish I'd done it, and I must do it.
I think that's a great idea. I went to the town where they filmed Jaws. I went to Martha's Vineyard.
Lovely.
And went around Jaws locations in Martha's Vineyard, and that was a grand day out. Really, really highly recommend that. That's a fantastic one. How about you, James? I guess Aliens hasn't left so many locations.
It would have been Acton Power Station. Yeah. So I really want to go around Acton Power Station.
The glamour.
Yeah. I mean, Tim Burton was the one who got the best of it, because when he turned up to do Batman, all of the alien sets were still intact, which they had to then dismantle. And there was a whole asbestos thing, but let's not get into that. I'd love to have been able to walk around the alien hive. That would have been incredible. Do you know what? The funny thing for me is, locations don't do it for me in the same way that sound stages do. And I know that sounds mad, but for me, the magic is being in the world. So when you go on set of something like, I went on Serenity, I think that was one of, if not the first set visit I ever did, and just walking on in the ship. I was in the ship. Like, it's like, this is absolutely insane. That stuff for me blows my mind. I think Game of Thrones locations would probably mean quite a lot to me. I went to Dubrovnik, but I went before Game of Thrones, so obviously it was meaningless at that point. I'd quite like to do that.
I mean, it's not meaningless, just to be clear. Dubrovnik is still a very nice place.
It's big for Croatians. It was meaningless to me. Oh. I'd like to go and do all the Northern Ireland locations from Game of Thrones. I would like to do that.
Come to my house, yes.
In terms of places I've been, obviously I have been to the Nostromo, because I was on set of the original Alien in 1979. And I have been to Hoth, because I was on set of The Empire Strikes Back.
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned it. So that was very exciting. But it's things like that. You and I, Helen, went on a pilgrimage to deep fry our kebabs. Not a euphemism.
We did.
But we went when we were in Edinburgh. Yeah, we went to the Avengers location. We've done a few like that.
Little spots like that. When you just like turn a corner and you're like, hang on a second. Isn't this where it was? That's always really special. Like the first time I ever went to New York was like that.
That's
just walking
amazing.
Down the street and you're like,
Did something shoot in New York?
A couple of things, you know, like just seeing the New York Public Library, I was just like, oh my God, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. I've done the whole LA tour thing when you get on a bus and they take you around and they're like, oh, there's a pretty woman balcony where he climbs up at the end with the flowers, and done all of that, which was quite fun. Talking of sets, like going on location, going on set of movies, the one that I almost did and they pulled the plug at the last minute, it fell through and I'm so gutted, is I was going on set of Doctor Sleep to the Overlook Hotel.
Oh.
You know, when they recreated the whole thing. Yeah, I was going to meet Mike Flanagan in the Overlook, and literally 2 days before I was flying, for some reason, they changed the filming schedule and it fell through and I was devastated.
Similarly, I went to the White Mountain Hotel, which is one of the ones that inspired the hotel in The Shining. It's not exactly the one, but it is mentioned in two of my favorite books. It's mentioned in A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, and it's mentioned in the aforementioned Julian May series. I'm sorry, it keeps coming up.
Here we go.
But I went there literally because of those books, and wanted to go because of those books. And I've been to the Awani in Yosemite, which is I think it's now the Yosemite Hotel. It's changed its name, but it's also one of the inspirations for the Overlook, which is cool.
I would like to go to the Wadi Rum.
Yes, me too.
Obviously, I mean, Lawrence of Arabia, naturally, but let's be honest, it's for Dune. And I remember, and you had this, didn't you, Helen? Where they're like, oh yeah, do you want to come on set of Dune? You're like, fuck yeah. And they're like, yeah, it's a soundstage in Budapest. And you're like, oh.
No, that was great. I'm not going to slag it off, but yes, also I would have liked to see some desert.
Like, if it's not Dune unless you're hanging out with sandworms. Like, you want to be in the deep desert.
I was on set of The Martian, and it was exactly the same. It was somewhere like Budapest, and it was just like, in a studio, massive fucking wind turbines. Like sand going everywhere, but it wasn't a distant planet.
No. It wasn't the Wadi Rum.
Ollie Richards did go to the Wadi Rum for The Martian, apparently. And
did he?
I think so. And he was sitting with Matt Damon just chatting in the desert under an umbrella.
That's amazing. I would love to. I bet it's hot as an absolute bastard, but I would love to do that.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. Also, Petra for The Last Crusade.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Three trials of such lethal cunning.
And that's another thing. I walked around a corner once in Venice when I was on a family holiday with my parents, and I'm like, this is the quote-unquote library, it's actually a church, where he goes to find the X marks the spot.
Amazing.
Just randomly, just crept up on me in Venice. Incredible.
It's mad, yeah. I went to Venice and spent the whole time just being in Don't Look Now land. That was it to me. Any dark alleyway, you know, shutters flapping in the wind at night. Yeah. I was there.
I was in Venice the other week, so I went on holiday to Italy, and I very nearly did a day trip pilgrimage to have a kind of an Attack of the Clones location visit.
Yeah.
I didn't in the end, so I didn't get to see the giant inflatable cow things, mainly because I hate sand.
Okay.
It's irritating, and it gets everywhere.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Of course, with an A. Okay, well, that's probably enough questions, I think, for now. Thank you so much for sending them in. I don't know where Chris will turn next week to ask for questions, so just keep active on all social media out there. Let us look to movie news, shall we? Most of what there is comes from D23 last week, I think,
yes,
I'm right in saying.
We should really have Ben here to talk us through it, but he's not in the office today.
Yeah, so, but what do we have? So let's talk a little bit about the X-Men casting, because we mentioned it last week, we were speculating about it, there had been
rumors.
And we
didn't do a special podcast, so we can do that now.
So we had speculated about some of these names, but they have now been announced. So if you still haven't seen Spider-Man Brand New Day, like, fast forward a few minutes. You're going to have to skip this section and just get your X-Men news somewhere else, because we're about to spoil a plot element in Spider-Man Brand New Day, okay? All right, so this is your warning. Go away. Okay, they've gone. So we can now say openly that Sadie Sink has been confirmed that she is playing Jean Grey. This is not a surprise to anyone who did see Spider-Man Brand New Day, but that is now open, that's out there, that is confirmed. We also know that Kit Connor of Heartstopper fame will be playing Cyclops, as widely rumored, and that Christopher Abbott will be Professor Charles Xavier.
That's the only one that's weirding me out at the moment. That's not to say he will be bad, but it is weirding me out.
So I've been thinking about it, because we were a bit skeptical of that when we talked about it last week, and I think he is the right face for it, but yes, I think of him as being much more hirsute.
Very much so.
So I'm going to be interested to see how he looks as a baldy. No disrespect.
No, it's fine. But, speaking for my people.
But yeah, that was interesting. And then we have a relative newcomer called Maya Boyd, who has up until now, I think, mostly been in theatre. This is definitely her film debut. I don't think she's done much TV, but she's played the lead role in And Juliet, I believe, on Broadway and done that kind of thing. So she's clearly very, very accomplished, and that'll be an interesting person to take that role. And then who am I forgetting? Indy Navarrete. Of Obsession fame,
yes,
as Rogue. And I am so happy about this, I cannot even tell you. You know why? Because Mystique is not a fucking X-Man, okay? And if she's going to be in this, if you're going to get an actress that good, I want her to be a fucking X-Man. So she's going to be Rogue. Fantastic. No notes. Really, really here for that.
That's the one I'm excited by. Out of all of that cast, it's Indy Navarrete. Yeah. Just the fact that, I mean, Obsession, the guy in Obsession, I thought was okay. I thought she was just barnstormingly
good. Oh my God, incredible.
Good. Yeah. Mm.
Just so terrifying. And just the force of her entering this world is very, very exciting to me.
And I think it sort of implies that they're going, you know, in an interesting direction with Rogue. I wonder if this is bad news for Carol Danvers.
I mean, it could be.
So just to explain that. Well, I don't know. just to explain that explain comment, it. Just for anybody who hasn't read the comics, because this hasn't really been done in the films before. So Rogue's power, for those who don't remember the original X-Men films or the comics, is that she absorbs other people's power. And if she only touches you for a couple of seconds, skin to skin, she maybe only gets your power for a short...
And an HR warning.
Warning, yes. She only gets your power for a short space of time. But if she kind of clings on for too long, she can basically suck the life straight out of you.
Wow.
And in the comics, she essentially, maybe not quite permanently because nothing is permanent in comics, but for a very long time, completely incapacitates Captain Marvel. Like, absolutely takes all of her powers for herself. And she can then fly, and she is then invulnerable, and Carol Danvers is just left as an ordinary person. So that was a really interesting thing, because in the comics, it actually gave Rogue a huge amount of guilt. She felt terrible about this. It wasn't intentional. She had been led on and had been, yes, working with the villains, but she herself was not a bad person. But she has this very sort of parasitic power that can do really bad things to people. So it's an interesting thing that they haven't they kind of delved into a little bit in the very first X-Men, but then they just turned it into this kind of star-crossed lovers thing and didn't really do very much with her as a person and that sort of sense of guilt and sense of fear of her own powers and those kind of things. So I'm kind of interested by this.
Oh, I agree. I think so. Also, it defines Rogue's powers as we understand them from the comics. Like, when we think of Rogue, we don't just think of, oh, yeah, she sucks people. Like, you think of her as having essentially Captain Marvel's powers, right?
Yeah.
As flying, being super strong, all that sort of stuff. And that's a really interesting side of Rogue that we've not seen in the live action stuff before. So I'm excited about that. I think Samara Weaving is going to be great as Emma Frost.
Oh, my God. Just perfect casting, no notes.
Very pleased about that. And again, not being funny, Adam Driver, Mr. Sinister.
That's good.
That's spot on.
That's really good. And I think also, you know, with love and respect, I don't expect Adam Driver to sign on to a 9-film deal for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think he's in for a one and done.
Yeah.
If not, I mean, maybe they've got a contract that says, look, we might want you to come back and, you know, cameo in somebody's dream sequence in 10 films time or something. And maybe he's like, yeah, fine. But I feel like he doesn't seem to be courting that kind of work. So I hope that means if he is signed up to it, that they've got something really fun, really exciting for him to do, and that also that's an arc with an end.
Do you not think he'd maybe do a trilogy, though, like Star Wars? I fully agree he's not going to do 10, but he may have signed up for 2 or 3.
I mean, look, it's possible, but I think I don't know that he entirely loved his Star Wars experience.
No.
So I wouldn't be surprised if this is a one and done. But look, again, this is not to say, oh, we'll see the last of Mr. Sinister. He may turn up again in smaller capacities.
Yeah, I mean, Sinister doesn't feel to me like necessarily a multi-arc villain.
Yeah.
It feels like you can dispense with him in an episode. But then Marauders, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, he's had a quite literal storied history. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, but good stuff. Also at D23, what else did we get? We got Frozen 3 details. There appears to be a baddie magic user there. Someone else with ice powers who interrupts Anna and what's his name's Kristoff's honeymoon and wedding and or wedding. So, you know, lots of trauma there to get into. That'll be fun. Coco 2 has also been announced.
Coco's with a dollar sign.
Coco's with a dollar sign through it. I mean, yes, probably. Unlike where are they putting the dollar sign?
Do you know they have to start the film with "Remember me" because the film was a while ago.
Hey, Frozen 3, where do they put the dollar sign there?
That's a good
Is it like
question.
A euro?
I think it's a euro sign in the E.
It's a euro for the E.
Or maybe in the 3, they do it.
Maybe in the 3,
maybe.
Okay.
And it's a pound sign.
Yes.
Yeah. There we go. Okay, thank goodness we figured this out. Anyway, Coco 2 will see our hero now as an adolescent, and he ends up back in the land of the dead and finds himself having to team up with Ernesto de la Cruz, his disgraced former idol, from last time. So Benjamin Bratt has confirmed he's back as Ernesto, and it sounds like it is going to be some kind of, well, X-Men 2 kind of team up of the bad guy from the last film with the good guy of the last film to take down or whatever. So apparently Benjamin Bratt said he was excited to bring him back to death, which I thought was a good little thing. I like that. But yeah, that's happening. So the last one won, what, 2 Oscars?
Oh, it's a lovely film as well.
It's a lovely film, made the best part of $1 billion. I guess I get why they're doing that. So that'll be interesting, I think. So that is Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina directing. Adrian Molina of Elio fame, if that's the word for Elio.
I was about to say, I'm not sure. of Elio, infamy.
Not infamy.
Hey, Helen.
They've all got it infamy, but Elio's fine. And also in the sequel news, so what was hilarious to me was that they brought Anne Hathaway out on stage to say that, yeah, we're working really hard on The Princess Diaries 3, but we have nothing to announce.
Amazing.
So, like, they haven't got it quite yet, but they're working on it, guys. Don't worry. It's happening.
I am hanging in there.
Hey, that is a generation-defining series of movies.
Okay. I want to talk about Romeo and Michelle's.
Oh my goodness.
That is the most exciting news.
It does look amazing.
Look, they invented Post-its. I get it. Yep. Like, they have a very storied history, but still.
So can you explain what Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion is to anyone who is unfamiliar with the oeuvre?
Well, it is Romeo and Michelle who are just BFFs and...
Played
by Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino.
Indeed.
And apparently in this sequel, they're looking for true love. So it's interesting if that will get between their friendship whatsoever.
Nothing can ever get between their friendship, I insist.
I can't remember a lot from the original. It's a long time since I've seen it, but I do remember that dance scene
where there's
incredible dancing around their handbags, isn't there? Yeah.
They are just living their best life in LA, but being called back for their high school reunion forces them to realize that maybe their best lives aren't that impressive. They haven't invented anything. They haven't gotten married. They haven't had kids. You know, there's nothing really to report. Except
they've got a boutique, haven't they? Fashion boutique.
Kind of, yeah, but it's not like a big deal. So they basically dress themselves up as business ladies in hilarious business suits and pretend that they invented Post-its and turn up to their thing. Unbeknownst to them, their friend, Janine Garofalo, does know the inventor of Post-its
of
and is able to call them on that. So they get in a little bit of trouble there. And there's a love triangle / love thread with Alan Cumming.
Yes.
As well. Yeah. So great cast. They're all still awesome. I mean,
it's just very funny and very sweet, the original.
Yeah. And very silly.
Yeah. Very silly. They're complete airheads.
And it's part of the Tarantino verse.
Oh, okay.
Because it features, I can't remember if it's Red Apple Cigarettes, but it features one of his brands because Mira Sorvino was dating Tarantino at the time when it was made. Hope that carries as well. Hey, he's still looking for his 10th film, right? Romeo and Michelle's continuing high school endeavors would make a great capper for his career.
That could be it. The high point.
Go out on a high.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Well, it's the one
we want to see.
There was also Zootropolis 3, which I thought, you're like,
who said there are no new ideas in Hollywood?
And Incredibles 3 came out, didn't
it? Incredibles 3 as well.
Did they not see Incredibles 2?
Well, apparently this one's going to focus on the kids, now teenagers.
Oh, yes. So they decided to make this one good. Okay, good.
Well, we can hope. Zootropolis 3 is going to be, well, Gary came along to introduce
the snake.
Yes. Well, no, but Kihui Kwan came along with Jennifer Goodwin to announce this one. Jason Bateman wasn't there, but we have to assume that the fox is back.
Well, he's a fox. He's sly.
Has to be. Non-negotiable. But apparently this one will feature birds. For all those who've been wondering, where are the birds in this world? The answer is the third installment.
Okay. I wasn't wondering that, but I'm glad to hear it.
Why not?
Yeah.
These are major questions that you should have been asking. Wow. Okay. A couple more things. There was more Doomsday footage.
There was a new trailer.
Yeah. What did you think?
I was very, very excited about this. My excitement for this film remains undimmed. I'm very psyched about it. I think Doom looks scary, fun. You're getting an idea for him. Like it's Sue Storm is essentially telling us, you know, his backstory and, you know, when his wife and child die and then he essentially turns to the dark side. And, you know, I'm feeling another...
Dark Side's a different comic book universe.
It's a different franchise. It's true, but it is still Disney, so it could be related. You know, I'm feeling another misunderstood villain and I'm here for it. I'm very, very excited.
I'm pre-exhausted. But, I mean, yeah, fine. Like, great. I don't know that I need him to have the most sympathetic backstory if he is going around stealing kids and destroying universes, but I'm sure we'll all enjoy it when it comes.
Yes.
But yes, this was actually pretty cool and did give you more of a sense of how the battle lines are being drawn, who's meeting who and when.
Yeah.
A little bit in this one. And also that it gives you that sense that there is a pre-existing relationship between the Fantastic Four and Doom, which I feel like is kind of an important thing to establish. Given
I mean, I guess we kind of know it, don't we? Yeah. Given that he's a historical, he is their nemesis, and that the obviously appears at the end of First Steps.
Exactly.
From behind.
But that's all we've had. So yeah. I feel like it is good to have a little bit of a speech somewhere in here explaining, well, you remember you saw the Latverian seat in our UN. Well, the reason for that is we've had long, long years of friendship with this guy, Victor Von Doom, who, despite his name, is super lovely. Yes. Just the biggest teddy bear.
Dr. Doom.
Well, yes, but, you know, it's just a local word meaning lovely, isn't it? So it's like Die Bart Die.
With all of these announcements coming out of D23, do you feel that the MCU is really back on track?
I think the jury's out on that.
Yeah.
I think Spider-Man is an anomaly, a very big anomaly with an enormous box office now that it has surpassed the box office gross of Infinity War.
Massive.
Which is, I mean,
at the US, I think, not worldwide.
Isn't it not worldwide?
I believe
so. No. Yeah, well, it's US, domestic. But I think once we've seen Doomsday, I think we'll be able to make a call on that.
Yeah.
Because we've talked about this many, many times. Doomsday isn't Infinity War. It hasn't earned what Infinity War had earned. Mm-hmm. And crucially, you don't have the investment in the characters you had going into Infinity War. So it's got a lot, not stacked against it, but it has a lot of ground to cover, and it has a much larger task ahead of it than Infinity War did, because it's not a pre-earned cinematic event. They want it to be one, and it may be one, but I don't think that's a given. But I think, you know, you could say that even if Doomsday dies on its arse, Spider-Man alone, that box office alone, I think has bought the MCU a decent amount of leeway. But I feel like if Doomsday really lands, then it does feel like, that comic movies and Marvel have got a second win. Yeah.
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 I'm thinking we're back.
It's going to be an interesting one because Disney actually has not had the best year overall. They do not get all that Spider-Man money. A lot of that is Sony, who own the character rights. A lot of what they've done this year has been maybe a bit disappointing. Toy Story 5 obviously being the big exception to that, but they have not had the best. No, but in terms of box office,
box office
and so on.
Yes.
But I think I think in terms of this year, it has not been, you know, an all-timer for them. So I think they're going to be hoping that next year, and certainly Doomsday, first of all, and then next year really brings it home. But they were really giving it the big hoopla, weren't they, and trumpeting Star Wars Starfighter with Ryan Gosling, which they're obviously hoping will be welcomed.
And they played the trailer in the room for that, didn't they?
Yeah, but I haven't seen it.
But we haven't seen it. Now, I really want to see that trailer because I think that, for me, is going to determine whether or not I'm excited or depressed.
But every day is Christmas Eve.
It is, but also I saw The Mandalorian and Grogu, which is not good, despite what Ben says. And I feel like, for me, Star Wars is in a bad place. And I think part of that is Andor's fault, honestly. I've talked about this before. I think Andor ruined Star Wars because it's so good and nothing else goes anywhere near it at this point. But I have some hope, a new hope, if you will, for Starfighter.
Just some daring do might fix it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Also potentially huge for 2028, I think, Fast Forever. Now, Vin Diesel, a man of unimpeachable integrity, who has never made an announcement that he could not immediately back up.
Right.
I want to be very clear on that.
Yeah.
Has said that shooting will start in December.
Okay.
And that they've been through four sets of writers.
Wow.
But the script that they now have made him cry. And he says even tough guys will cry sometimes.
So unless he falls out with one or more of his castmates before then...
What
that would never happen.
Come on.
Not Vin.
I do, at this point, I'm like, for fuck's sake, we've been through 10 films. Give us the last one, for God's sake. I just want to see it. And I want it to be everything. I want it to be the most over-the-top, bombastic, ridiculous cinematic experience known to man. And if it's anything less than that, it's a failure.
It will be.
That seems entirely fair. Wow.
Yep.
He was talking at the 25th, God help us, anniversary of the first Fast and Furious film. But he literally said by the end of the script that we crafted and worked so hard to make right for you after 4 years. I was crying. I couldn't hold it back. And I had to tell everyone. And my sister said, no more crying, bro. So I just want to say that sometimes even the toughest guys in the world need to cry.
That's lovely. Look at him.
Is it, though? Because this is the bit that worries me. Because I've always felt like Fast and Furious is hilarious and everyone is in on the joke except Vin Diesel. And if that screenplay made him cry, I put it to you that it is maybe not doing what we all think it's going to do.
That's true. I like the fact that his sister said to him, no more crying, bro.
Yeah, no more crying. This is hilarious. A guy just headbutted a tank. And it's like, well, okay, fine.
But look, I like that, maybe family, that makes him though. Cry. If you headbutted a tank, your eyes would water too.
It would
too.
Make me cry.
So,
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. And last we heard, Louis Leterrier hadn't read the script, even though he's meant to be directing it. So, but he said, there will be an ending and it's great. I was very, very lucky to be part of the franchise and I love Vin and I love Universal. So, yeah, we'll see.
There will be an ending. It's great. I haven't read it yet, but it's great.
There's still time. But, yeah, it's happening probably, guys. So, hooray.
That franchise will never get more emotional than when Paul Walker drives off. Is it number 7?
Yeah, yeah.
They go their separate ways. That, I mean, that genuinely killed
me. Yeah, that was genuinely emotional.
Really emotional.
Yeah. It was.
So did Vin cry then? I'm sure he did.
I think he did. We should also finish with some very sad news that came out this week, which is obviously the death of Hayden Panettiere at the age of just 36. I think for many of us, she sort of defined a moment with Heroes and with the Save the Cheerleader kind of slogan and her character that came out of that, which was wonderful. But she did incredible work in Nashville. Just really stunning and really sad news. And not the only person that we lost this week.
No, we also lost John Irvine, who's a British filmmaker, a lot older than Hayden. He was 86 when he passed, but people will know him. He directed Raw Deal, one of the early Arnie films. He did the original Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy with Alec Guinness on TV, which won various awards and is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
I
really
urge
is.
People to seek it out if you haven't seen it.
I think it's still on iPlayer if
yeah,
you haven't seen
I'm
it.
I'm sure it is. And the film's tremendous as well, but this being kind of 5 episodes, 5 hours, goes a little bit deeper. It's fantastic. And he also made John Irvine. He made Hamburger Hill, which was part of that whole kind of late 80s Vietnam War when you had, you know, Platoon and Full Metal Jacket and all of those films coming out. And Hamburger Hill at the time, I mean, I was only about 15 and I was really into my Vietnam films. And for a moment, it was my favourite just because it was so gory. It's just a bunch of guys going up a hill and just attack after attack being repelled and just blood and limbs everywhere. Watching it, you know, later on in life, it's maybe not as good as the other ones from that cycle of movies, but it's still well worth seeking out. So it is a real loss, John Irvine.
Yeah, absolutely. So our thoughts go out to their families and friends today, but this is it's been a sad week, especially with, you know, the tributes pouring into Hayden Panettiere at such a young age. All right, well, I think that's enough news for today. Let's move on to an interview. And I will say we are delighted this week to be joined by Jane Schoenbrunn, who is, of course, the director behind We're All Going to the World's Fair and I Saw the TV Glow. And they are back this week with the fantastic Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma. Now, to be clear, the Empire Pause podcast is not endorsing teenage sex or death. Actually, but we do endorse this film in which a young filmmaker played by Hannah Einbender tries to persuade the reclusive original star of a horror franchise that she's rebooting to sign on once more. That's Gillian Anderson's character. And we also obviously endorse Schoenbrunn themselves as well. So we sent Harry Stainer along to find out more. Please enjoy.
Jane Schoenbrunn, welcome to the Empire podcast. Your film is in US cinemas today. How are you feeling?
It's like a little bit of a like end of a marathon feeling, honestly, because you when you make a movie, you have so many opportunities to sort of like celebrate it for the quote unquote last time. You know, there's the you wrap production, we made the movie, you know, you finish the edit, we locked the picture, we actually finished the movie, it's done, the festival premiere, etc., etc. So it's been just like half a year of celebration, honestly, and getting to share it with audiences. I think I've been at Q&A's every night for the last 2 weeks, getting to hear audiences react to it, laugh, which is really nice, talking about it to the press, seeing the reviews. It's like such a long road leading to it. It almost feels like the bottom of a water slide, you know? It's like, all right, now it's dropped into the water and it's out in the world for real. So accomplished and tired.
I was going to say, you were saying laughed, and I think that was the thing when I first saw this. I was like, this is an incredibly funny film at points. And I think Hannah and Gillian have such a kind of like lovely stoner dynamic. And I was like, how did you go about building that dynamic on set?
The dynamic between Hannah and Gillian?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they both showed up having done so much work, like figuring out their takes on these characters. And in a lot of ways, like, they're like freaky, weird takes on the characters. Like, they each had the kind of like individual comic understanding of like who these people were in like the way that the movie is about two weird people meeting each other and forming a connection. And then I do remember the, yeah, I think it was like 3 days before we started shooting when we first got the two of them together in a room. And they were so dialed in to like the comic timing. I remember like sitting there being like, oh, we've got like a good movie. Like, the movie in many ways is just like a house for the two of them to live in. And they were so, yeah, the chemistry was just there. They had done all of this work to prep, but then there is also this element of like, it really only is going to hit if they're, if the fire is there. And the fire was just there in both like the performers and these strange people that they had created.
Yeah, I wanted to take you back to the kind of the opening montage of the film, because you're essentially creating what is someone who is Little Death is meant to be someone that exists alongside kind of Freddy and Jason. And where's the starting point of coming up with that kind of iconography of like making like a horror villain that's meant to have existed through like multiple eras, essentially?
I think the key thing for me was not doing something that was like a contemporary referential sort of reflection on the iconography of the slasher film, but to like sort of put myself through the thought experiment of like, if I was alive in 1983 and I was like, oh, there's Jason, there's Freddy, there's Mike Myers, like, who's my guy? Which honestly, like, I remember thinking about that in high school. Like, that's not a new question for me. That's like a fun question. But I do feel like it's been 40 years or whatever of slasher movies at this point. And now the like cliches of the medium are so well refined that it's like when we see another hockey mask or like something that feels like the off-brand, like store, you know, the store brand of like hockey mask. It's like, oh, we made it look like close enough to remind you of Jason or Mike Myers without getting sued. It feels so much less exciting, or it feels like it starts to feel like an impression of the thing rather than the thing, you know? And so this is something that you have some experience with my movies, is trying to like cross through all the way to like not doing a throwback to pastiche in the obvious way that we're used to, you know, but getting like right into the heart of it. Like, even with TV Glow, I remember being like, no fucking bicycles in this movie. Like, kids are not allowed to ride on bicycles because bicycles in the suburbs are like overdone. You know, it's been bled of its power. So then the question became like, I knew that the question was like, how do I create something that like could be believably iconic in the way that like a Jason or a Freddy or a Mike Myers was iconic? And I knew it needed to be something like simple, but incredibly memorable. And then I was lying in bed at my ex's house, or at my ex's parents' house, one Christmas, and I was staring up at the ceiling and I saw the air vent. You know, this thing that here in the US is on like every ceiling in the country almost. It's like that symbol of those boxes within boxes. I know maybe doesn't quite travel in the same way, but in America, it's like it's completely ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And it's everywhere in this invisible way, where it's so common that you don't really see it anymore. In the same way, for instance, that like power lines stretch across the country, but we kind of like have learned to look past them. I just saw it and I was like, oh, that's the mask. There it is. And I didn't overthink it, because to overthink it would have been beside the point. It needed to be like, like one of these elements in the movie that like makes an uncanny intuitive sense, but not like a metaphorical sense.
I think it's perfect because I was in the cinema the other day and I saw like a standee of Little Death. Yes. And my brain just went like, oh, it's a horror film. And yep. then I was like, I'd already seen the film. And I was like, oh, wait, that's Camp Miasma. And it's instantly you're like, oh, Freddy, Jason. And I think that opening sequence, because you kind of paint such a rich history of the franchise, I kind of wanted to ask, like, you're riffing on like Army of Darkness in that opening. You're riffing on Jason Takes Manhattan, which is a personal favorite of mine. Was there any, and the arcade machine I was just obsessed with, was there any that didn't make the cut? Because it's so rich in terms of what you're pulling from and all these like bits of memorabilia.
No, I think I got most of the jokes in there that I wanted to. Perhaps there were some pieces of memorabilia that just from like a budget perspective, we couldn't create. I'll tell you about one joke that we couldn't get to work that I thought was a really funny joke was the first reboot, like a big part of that opening credit sequence for me and the joy of it, right, is like speaking the language fluently of just like tired old IP. Because that becomes almost like a genre unto itself that like, if we zoom out and look at as like, they made all those sequels, they went to space, they got worse and worse. Then they rebooted it again. Now they're doing like a prequel TV series. It's like, there's a logic to it. And like, you can track these trends, not just in horror films, but in a lot of our like endlessly recycled, remade and regurgitated pieces of intellectual property that I think like tells a fun story that is the story of like capitalism in some ways. Like that, the storytelling and the reason it works, it's not just like, look at all of these different, these pieces of memorabilia that you remember. There's something of like the decades passing in that sequence that I think is really a pleasure. So there was this one moment that we were gonna do and we shot it, but it just like it didn't work. It was like the rhythm is so important, and it just cut off the rhythm too much. But like we were gonna do this joke where you see the fake trailer for the first reboot.
Okay.
Like you think the opening credits are over after he like goes to space and he's like washed up. And then we were going to have this like voiceover that was like 30 years ago. Like he emerged from the bottom of the lake and like, and kind of do this like fake out where it really feels like, oh, now it's like a good, you know, it's like, now it's like prestige again. Now we're like getting serious. And then the camera was going to slowly pull out and you were going to see a computer. It was like the trailer was playing on a TV screen and you were still in the museum and there was a computer next to it with Rotten Tomatoes pulled up. And it was like, then we were going to like rack focus to the computer screen and it was just going to be like critic score 4%, you know, like because there was this funny bit, it was kind of like the Platinum Dunes era of like elevated horror remakes when it was like Michael Bay was like producing all of these like serious, humorless, gnarly reboots of classic slasher.
It's like your Nightmare on Elm Street reboot essentially.
Yeah, or Friday the 13th. Yeah. Texas Chainsaw or like House of Wax, like that era of movie that like at the time, because it was the first time they had been like, well, fuck all the other movies. Like we've driven these properties into the ground. Let's like go back to the beginning. and I like, there's some humor. I think it's like what Scream didn't get to comment on in 1996, yeah. Right? Is that it's like, let's like reclaim the like vitality of these franchises. And it's like, no, those sucked. And then they tried it again and those sucked. And then they tried it again and those kind of sucked too. Now you're talking about like late stage capitalism.
I also wanted to quickly talk about the film in terms of like your journey as a filmmaker, because we've like World's Fair and TV Glow being made at a point where you were like during transitioning, and those films kind of, especially TV Glow, explores this idea of dysphoria. And I think one of the things that surprised me about this film and really moved me was this is such like a euphoric celebratory film. Like what was the intention of making something so like joyful at this point in your life?
Yeah. I mean, it's not something I'm always going to do. In fact, I think like the next challenge for me is to like treat transition as a little less of a muse for me. Because it's just like, I'm 6 years in at this point. Obviously my perspective on the world and my life is like completely colored by being trans, but like, I'm not going through the same kind of like adolescence, or like literal like transition from one reality to another that I was 5 years ago. It's like part of who I am, but it's not like the thing that my life is about at the moment. Which is nice. You know, like I'm happy about that. It feels like, yeah, people talk about transition as they call it second puberty. In many ways, it felt like first puberty for me because like I needed a do-over. And I do feel like I'm through, you know, I think transition and change is obviously like that lasts one's whole life. Whether or not you're trans, you're constantly changing and growing, but yeah, the discrete sort of like learning of the things that I needed to learn about myself as a trans person, which I think in many ways are the things that everyone else learns about themselves as cis people, like a lot earlier, like I kind of speed ran that and feel a bit through it. But for these first three movies, like transition, my personal gender transition was in many ways the muse. And the reason the filmography starts there is that like before looking at that part of myself, I just like, I couldn't make art. I was hiding. And so those two things have also been deeply intertwined, right? My like coming into myself as an artist and my coming into myself as a person, have met each other. For World's Fair, that was a process of like literally just understanding it. I was working on that movie for like the half decade that it took me to like come out to myself. And by the end of that process of writing that script, I was like, oh, I thought there wasn't a word for what this movie was about, but there is, and it's dysphoria. TV Glow, which I wrote the script for 2 months into my actual physical gender transition, when I was still dealing with like all of the fallout of coming out at 32, you know, and being like going from being like straight married corporate job working man to like, yeah, something very, very different. That movie is about like the like emotional atomic bomb that sets off and like knowing that that's coming and that being part of like repression. So neither movie is actually so much about transition itself. It's about, they're about like getting to the point of transition. Whereas Miasma, it's like, I sort of describe like early transition sometimes as, it's like getting on SSRIs where it's like, you have all of the bad side effects for the first couple months and then it starts to feel good. This is a movie about the like starting to feel good. And the starting to feel good is complicated because you're like not just understanding intellectually, but you're really feeling a thing that has been ephemerally broken for your whole essentially life. Starting to feel a little less broken. And you're coming into yourself, but you're also coming into yourself with like a lot of accumulated trauma, and a lot of like self-consciousness, especially about being in your own body, and feeling comfortable opening parts of yourself up that have been completely closed down. And so that's really what this one is about, is like that process and specifically that process as it relates to sex and sexuality, which was scary and tender and joyful and fun and, you know, and sticky. And so the movie had to be too.
I just wanted to quickly touch on what you're up to next, which is an adaptation of Charles Burns' Black Hole. And this is your first time adapting something. Is that something you feel like you have to stay close to the source material, or is it kind of an opportunity to have your own spin on that graphic novel?
Definitely the latter. I am not going to be very faithful to like the plot or even like characters, you know, like the literal, like the literal things that happen in that graphic novel. Black Hole for me, and I it's my favorite book. I read it as a teenager, and it like captured this thing that like I always wanted my own work to capture, because it just felt so close to me, this like mix of like teenage feelings and grotesque imagery, romance and horror, you know, and the way that like alienation can feel romantic or comforting when you're a young person, and then the ways that like society wants to kind of like ground that down. And so I'm staying very true to that. And I'm staying very true to that as this like lineage that that book, I think, kind of invented. Like, I feel like there are so many filmmakers and films that have been influenced by Black Hole over the years that are also among my, it's like, it's, there's almost like a body of work that I don't view this as like the first time Black Hole has been in the world. It's like, it follows as Black Hole, in my opinion. And yeah, I don't know. I kind of like gave myself the gift when I pitched on it, because especially it's a TV show, so it needs to change, to sort of use it as a jumping off point to like my own obsessions and my own world and story. And yeah, it'll be very, very different from the book while still having these like flickers of the book. If anything, it's like, in the process of developing it so far, whenever I feel like a little lost, I'll take out the book and reread it and just like sometimes just like stare at the images for a morning, because it's like it becomes this North Star aesthetically and emotionally for me, more than it's like, oh, and I need this to be like the story and how it plays out.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
All right, that was Jane Schoenbrunn, and I think it's time for reviews, and I feel like that's the only place to start. Let's talk about teenage sex and death at Camp Miasma. Jamie.
Well, I absolutely adored this film, like one of my top three of the year. Very much made for me. I mean, I grew up, I loved slasher movies as a teenager, still love slasher movies, and it's very much set in that 80s slasher world. But this filmmaker is a kind of queer indie filmmaker who's looking to reboot the Camp Miasma series from the 1980s, but wants to do it very much through a modern lens, kind of investigating psychosexual politics and things like that, and sort of the idea of seeing and being seen and blurring the boundaries between real life and movies. There's a lot of going on in this film, sex and death kind of merging those as well. And she is obsessed with finding the original star, the final girl from the first Camp Miasma film to star in her reboot, and actually tracks her down at the original Camp Miasma, where obviously the first one was filmed. So it's like going to the camp in Friday the 13th and finding, you know, the final girl from there is still living there, isolated, completely on her own, living in this world of trauma and memories. This star is played by Gillian Anderson, who's absolutely great in it as this kind of recluse, this forlorn diva. There's a bit of Sunset Boulevard going on in there as well, sort of withdrawn from the world. And so begins this conversation between them where Chris, the filmmaker, is trying to persuade her to come into this film. And it is basically very much a love letter to 80s slasher movies. Anyone who ever read Carol J. Clover's book, Men, Women and Chainsaws, which was a major tome in like 1992, and it opened up all the doors of sort of taking horror films seriously and introduced the whole idea of how the idea of a final girl in horror films makes young men identify with women in that position, because before then people were saying, oh, it's just tits and arse and it's people being killed and it's very voyeuristic and male and horrible. And this book sort of opened the idea that actually, no, it takes these viewers, which at the time was considered mainly men, and puts them in the shoes of a final girl fighting against a masked killer and sort of makes them identify. So it's really interesting. And this is almost like a filmic version of that, that it takes all of these ideas and puts them into this movie, but at the same time is so much fun. It could have been really dry. It could have been really academic, but it's full of like bursting gore, hosing blood. It's very, very funny. It's very personal as well, with the whole sort of sexual politics that obviously Jane Schoenbrunn is a non-binary trans filmmaker, puts a lot of themselves into this film. And it's just really, really interesting. It's just so many swirling ideas and so much fun. And I know that James hated it.
I did. It is true. Now, for me, this was a little bit like reading an incredibly pretentious film studies paper, except with someone occasionally getting impaled up the bum with a big old spear. So, look, I have nothing against metatextual commentary. I actually rather enjoy it. But for me, what needs to happen is it needs to exist in parallel what I think is like really compelling storytelling. And what I lacked, what I didn't get from this was a compelling story. I understood all the references. Well, I didn't understand all the references. You understood all the references, Jamie. I understood a percentage of the references. And I appreciated what was being done. But like, take something, and I know it's a really first base example. But take something like Scream, right? You take out all of the commentary there that Kevin Williamson was doing. You take out all of the meta stuff. What you've got is a great slasher movie. Like, it's really fun. It's got a great story. It's got like a twist. It's just fun. You could never have seen another film and you'll get everything you need out of Scream. I don't think that's true of this film. So I think if you take all that out, what you've got is something which for me was actually just quite boring. And I didn't really gel with it in that way because I didn't find it scary. I found it occasionally funny. Some of the gags are good. They tend to be quite, you know, in jokey cinema typey gags. There's a jump scare gag, which is quite accessible. I found that very funny. But I didn't find it hugely suspenseful. So I guess what I'm saying is this is a film that has and will get a slew of five-star reviews, not just from you, Jamie, from all sorts of people. The reviews have been glowing, but it is also a film aimed at film critics. And I feel like if you're the kind of person who sees a five-star review and says, right, I must see that, I would say watch the trailer, read the review, understand what it is, because it will not be for everyone. I think if you are someone for whom a running gag about split diopters has you howling in the aisles, this is definitely the film for you. If not, I'm just saying, know what you're getting before you go in.
Maybe don't watch the trailer, because the trailer is really misrepresentative of the film.
Is it? So I've not watched the trailer.
It tries to say it's more of a straight slasher
film. I can only imagine what the marketing team thought when they first saw it. They were what the fuck are we going to do with this? It's also, as you said, it's quite gnarly. So it's not, as a horror film, it's not scary, but it is quite unpleasant.
I think there are moments of scare. I was scared because I didn't know what it was going to do. And I didn't trust where it was going to end up. And so I spend a lot of the film quite tense about what was going to happen next. There is an element, obviously, of kind of, you know, almost psychological warfare between the two women. You were very unsure of Gillian Anderson's, Billy, of her kind of motives and what she wants out of this when they meet. It seems pretty obvious pretty quickly that she doesn't just intend to easily sign up to this film. So why has she got this young woman here? And what is she planning to do with her? I was genuinely quite unsettled by that. There's an element of almost kind of supernatural something or other going on. And you're not quite sure what that is. And it sort of plays with your expectations and plays with your understanding of the genre in ways that I find quite effective. I think it's really funny. I think you're underselling the funniness.
To be fair, me and comedy have a troubled relationship.
Yes.
So,
but like the split diopter shot was like the least of it, but that was really good. It does get laughs out of knowing the genre, but also gets laughs out of, you know, ridiculous meetings that this director she's trying to get on Zoom calls with her team back in Hollywood, and just the absolute disconnect between what she's going through and what they're talking about is hilarious. And you don't have to be an expert in film to get that. If you're a fan of like The Studio, you know, you'll get some more jokes from those scenes, but you don't need that. So I just find it was really effective, and I did not see where it was going, and I did not expect it to end up where it ended up. And I thought that was a good thing.
Helen just said something which I was going to say exactly right about the fact that it really sends up Hollywood as well, that a lot of what James has said is true. And if you're into your horror films and you know all the references, you'll maybe get more out of it. But anyone with even a passing kind of knowledge of film or cinema will get the fact that, you know, these Hollywood execs what they want, which is a very lowest common denominator horror film, you know, with just lots of people being killed. It's very, very different to what this filmmaker, this art house indie filmmaker wants to make. And their conversations are hilarious, kind of dumb Hollywood, but at the same time, also sending up the filmmaker and people who over intellectualize horror movies, like Carol J. Clover with Men, Women and Chainsaws. You know, as much as I'm on side of that, and I love to talk shit about horror movies and get deep on horror movies, there are people, myself included, who maybe go too deep and was spent hours and hours discussing things that maybe weren't even intended. And it doesn't lose sight of the fact that those people could be absolute twats as well. So I think it's very funny for that as well. You know, it's kind of playing both sides of a fence.
I absolutely agree. We gave it 5 stars.
We did. So. How far that alongside Nirvana and things that I'm utterly upset about this year.
You are so wrong. Okay, well, but it is a 5-star film. That is a big recommendation. But maybe take James's views on board if you too have no comedy gene. I mean, what? Who said that? Well, oh, God. Anyway, next up, a little bit of a change of pace. Jason Statham has made his film again.
He has.
James, tell me about Mutiny.
Bless him. That is a man who knows what his audience wants and he gives it to them. This is a film by Jean-François Richer. And he did that mad Jerry Butler film, Plane. Do you remember that? We reviewed not so long ago.
Plane is great.
Right? Yeah. And he did the 2005 Assault on Precinct 13 remake as well, if you remember.
And he did Mezrine,
which
didn't
was
he,
all right.
As well?
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
Mm. Anyway, it is also the latest Statham thriller in which our craniumed crusader. He plays a guy called Cole Reed, and he's a former Met officer with a weirdly non-specific mid-Atlantic accent. I don't know quite what was going on there. It's occasionally Australian, but let's not dwell on that. So he now works as a bodyguard to this wealthy businessman. He's based in Thailand, and this is a guy who has come to see him as a part of the family. We know this because he buys him a watch at the beginning. And his friend and employer gets brutally assassinated on his watch, and old Cole Reed stows away aboard the cargo ship that one of the killers who killed him, he was posted on. So in order to try and find out what is what. Meanwhile, the reluctant third mate of that ship, played by Annabelle Wallace, is posted to the ship at the last minute, only to discover that her crew are not exactly on the up and up. You kind of know what you're getting with a Statham film. You know, you're getting, you know, great action. You're getting fun set pieces. You know, RJ's essentially fucking shit up. Like that's what you bought the ticket. Now, there's also a subsection, I would argue, of Statham films that are genuinely elevated beyond the genre. You know, they outperform the source material and in many ways the script, and they become an absolute hoot. Guy Ritchie has directed a few of the recent ones of old Statham. What else have we got? The Magnificently Stupid Beekeeper, I think, falls into this category as well.
Crank, I would
Crank,
argue.
Crank, 100%. It's like the gold standard of this stuff. Mutiny is not one such film. So, oh God, where do I start? Right, so let's start with the good. It has pretty decent action, I would say. The choreography is pretty good. The energetic direction, I think, gives it a real sort of zhuzh to the fight sequence, often in close quarters as well, so that's pretty fun. Look, the Statham can kind of punch someone in the face like very few other people. He does it very, very well. The story is utter drivel.
I had a better time, I think, with this film than you did.
You did, but then they did give you canapés because you went to the premiere.
They did give me canapés because I went to the premiere. And the Statham was in the row in front of me.
There you go.
And he sat
you
for the whole
like
film.
It.
Sat for the whole film. Just saying. Not everybody does all the time.
No,
so
that's good.
That's a vote of confidence on his part. But I am saying, what was interesting to me is that there are decisions that make no sense.
None.
So he finds this, you know, as you say, this sort of lading card for this guy.
Yeah.
Going, this guy's going to get on a cargo ship tonight after killing my boss.
A guy who is also bald.
Yeah. But then he suddenly decides to take the guy's idea and board the cargo ship. What's the thought process, Jace?
Yeah.
Why do you think that will solve the mystery of who done it? What possible reason is there to take this man's place on a ship? How is that going to... That could just be his escape route.
I mean, it makes no sense. But then equally, while pretending to be the other bald man, he wears a hat. And you're like, dude, the only thing you have in common with this guy is you're both bald. Take that. Anyway, that's a relatively minor point. But look, the story, as we say, is drivel. It's kind of obvious where this is going from the beginning. The dialogue is horrific. And look... That's not always a problem. And I think Arnie dealt with some really great scripts from Steve D'Souza. But the thing that Arnie had is he had a twinkle in his eye, and The Rock does this as well, which elevates the material because he knows it's stupid. And respect where it's due, Jace often knows that as well. You look at Crank, you look at Spy. The man is genuinely very funny when he wants to be. This is acutely humorless. It is the most po-faced film. And so the dialogue that he's having to twist himself through, it just thuds down like an anchor and it's absolutely hideous. So, you know, it needed a little beekeeper lunacy to it. It needed some of that fun, some of that kind of like crazy stuff. And I think, and you don't get any of that in there. And then there's the other thing. Why the fuck is it called Mutiny? He's not even a member of the crew. Like, call it The Stowaway. Call it Death at Sea. I don't know, but the... What, oh. Anyway, that's a relatively minor bugbear, but it kind of bothered me. Look, this is not a film, I think, that warranted a theatrical release, and yet here we are.
Wow. Jamie?
I think the Stave makes two kinds of movies. He makes the slightly serious, somber ones like Hummingbird, Wrath of Man, Safe, and this one, Mutiny. And then he makes the ones we mentioned like Crank and like Spy.
Wrath of Man is good.
Yeah, Wrath of Man's better than this. And he makes the ones where they're very sort of tongue-in-cheek. This is certainly the former one where it's the Stave being serious. You know, it's shot very sort of bleak. It looks really miserable, leached of all colour, you know, kind of breeze block grey visuals. Like you said, the fight scenes, which are actually quite good, are very short and sharp and real, just sort of violent and punchy, but they're not big choreographed fun fight scenes. And there's not many of them. There's not enough of them. But for me, where this movie really, really falls down is it's trying to be very serious. It's trying to be somber. But like the plot, the whole conspiracy plot is not interesting.
No.
It doesn't grab your attention. You don't really give a shit, you know, what the outcome is.
If you don't spot whodunit in the first 10 minutes,
no,
there's something wrong with
that. Then you're on your phone.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, you must be. You know exactly whodunit and who was working with who. I mean, from scene one, you know that poor Ramon Tikaram's character, his boss, Tibu, he could not be more doomed. He is more doomed than Dead Meat Thompson in Hot Shots. I have never met a more doomed character, God bless him. But, you know, I still had fun. It's so stupid, but I had fun. Roland Muller as the ship captain was very evil. I enjoyed that. Annabelle Wallace was utterly unconvincing. I mean, she is radiantly beautiful and we're meant to buy her as this hardened sailor. I'll be honest, I struggled a little bit. No disrespect to beautiful women who work on cargo ships. I'm sure there are many, many of you out there. But I didn't 100% buy that as a character for her.
It's interesting that you mentioned Plane at the start, which is the same writer and the same director, because apparently, and I don't think this has been 100% confirmed, but almost definitely this started off as a sequel to Plane and was originally...
What was Boat?
Yeah, it was originally called Ship.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. That is amazing. But then I feel like Plane has a playfulness to
it. Yes, and this doesn't.
And this really doesn't.
Yeah. No, it doesn't, and it should do.
I think Adrian Lester's got a little sense of playfulness.
He's got a twinkle in his eye.
He's got a twinkle. Mm. He is... I just saw him on stage last week, so I'm very much in a pro Adrian Lester mood. If you haven't seen Cyrano de Bergerac, his Cyrano is incredible. But he plays this, you know, sort of naval captain that they're trying to get in touch with and who's sort of getting suspicious about the boat. And I liked him. He had a little bit of a...
In the three scenes that he has, he's very curious.
Anyway, we give it 2 stars. So
fair.
I'm a little bit higher. I would probably go 3 because I just had a nice time. But I accept the verdict.
I would give it 2 and I did give it 2 because I wrote the review in Empire. But I would say if you want to watch someone creeping around on a ship and beating the shit out of people every now and then, go to Under Siege.
Yes, 34 years ago,
and so much better.
I don't think we can. I watched it again a couple of years ago.
Under Siege.
I cannot sign off on that.
Die Hard on a boat.
Under Siege is great.
And nothing but love.
Helen.
Love for Tommy Lee Jones, but I cannot put Steven Seagal over Jason Statham.
I'm not making great claims for Under Siege. I'm not saying it's Die Hard. I'm not saying it's First Blood. I'm not saying it's Terminator, but it is a damn solid
movie. It's a genuinely very good film. And it's Steven Seagal's best by a country mile.
Well, I mean, wow, that's grading on the curve. Anywho, 2 stars then for Mutiny. Yes. We should also talk now. Insidious Out of the Further, as we record, has not screened for critics. I apologize to all of you Insidious fans who are waiting on that one with bated breath. You will have to check back on the website later in the week. But we have seen And Sons. So what can you guys tell me about And Sons? Jamie.
Well, Anson's is about a sort of really grouchy, washed up alcoholic writer. He's a kind of literary god called Adrian Andrew Dyer, sorry, who is played by Bill Nighy. And he's one of those writers where he's, you know, put his whole life, his whole soul into it, which means that his family is very fractured and very resentful. His sons never got any of his time. And he had an affair, and his youngest son is the result of that affair. So that split up the whole family. His wife, played by Imelda Staunton, left him, said enough's enough. And he's basically drinking himself to death on his own. And the idea of this film is that he brings back his family, he brings back his sons by saying, I'm dying, I want to kind of make amends, I want to talk to you. So one son is called Jamie, played by George Mackay, who's a documentary filmmaker. The other son is Richard, played by Johnny Flynn, who is a screenwriter. And they both come back into the house full of resentment, full of anger, and sort of have it out with their father. So there's a lot of kind of really going at it, locking horns, deep, oh, meaningful, grouchy talk. There's a little bit of humour as well. When Imelda Staunton comes into it, whenever she's in a room with Bill Nighy, you know, two great actors, there's real sparks, you know, there's real kind of oomph, depth to the drama. But unfortunately, and I can't say more because I don't want to give away a major twist to the film, but there's a twist in the
middle.
They're
all ghosts.
It's not that far, but it's almost as ridiculous as that, actually. Oh, no. Almost. But there is a twist which is kind of hard to take seriously, that puts a whole new light on the film, and it makes it slightly silly given how serious it all is as well. I would say the director is a guy called Pablo Trapero, who's Argentinian. And if you want to see him make a film about a dysfunctional family, he made a movie in 2015 called The Clan, which is a true life story about a dysfunctional crime family who in the 80s kidnapped people and killed people. And that film is absolutely terrific. Mm. So go and see that. Don't go and see Anne's Sons, which I'm very, very lukewarm about.
Yeah, we gave it 2 stars, I'm afraid, which is a shame because, like, you know, as you say, great people involved. Sarah Polley wrote the script. I mean, we expected more, but 2 stars for Anne's Sons, which brings me at last to Stop That Train.
Which we should say, you banned me from watching.
I respectfully suggested that it might not be your cup of tea.
And that it didn't deserve whatever it is I would say about it.
It didn't deserve the kicking that you would give it, is my view.
Fair.
So Stop That Train is a kind of, it's a quasi-airplane, but obviously set on a train, Die Hard on a train, or more, you know, Airplane on a train.
Under Siege 2, Die Hard on a train.
No, anyway, this is Adam Shankman directing.
Dark territory.
And it's very much a sort of RuPaul production. So the idea in this film is that there are many, that the US has a rich train culture. Okay, so that's the first joke.
Yeah.
The US has a rich train culture, and that there is a super luxury train that is going back and forth across the US. And all seems to be well with this train, the Glamazonian Express, until a major storm threatens it. And the result of several lightning strikes means that it becomes a runaway train. The Stormaganza has created this horrendous situation. So all those aboard the train, who include 2 new stewardesses, Tess and Dee Dee, who have just been find themselves out of a job when Stankrail collapsed. They're played by Tess as Ginger Minge, and Dee Dee is played by Jujubee, both Drag Race stars, for those of you who are not familiar with their oeuvre. And they basically have to save the train, which involves much chaos. Helping, or let's be honest, sometimes hindering them from doing this, is RuPaul as President Judy Gagwell. And you also have just an incredible supporting cast. Rachel Bloom plays a sort of person back in the weather center who's trying to guide them through the storm. How you can guide somebody on a train is a fascinating question. There's also silly people like Missy Pyle is in it. Chris Parnell is in it. Sarah Michelle Bloody Gellar is in it. It has an incredible sort of deep cast of just like supporting cameos and little tiny appearances. Lisa Rinna, Jerry O'Connell, or Ricky Lindholm all turn up for like a scene at most. I had a really good time. the hit rate is not airplane levels of hit rate. You know, this is not a film where all 273 gags in its 89 minutes are bangers. They have not shot this around college campuses all over the country and cut out anything that didn't work. But it is only 90 minutes, and it does have a high enough rate of comedy, I thought, or rate of jokes, that even though the hit rate was probably only about 50% for me, that was still a regular supply of jokes, you know? So I find this really fun. I think James would hate it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I think you do have to have a sort of tolerance for that kind of drag race humor, which sometimes is hit and miss for me. Like, there are some episodes of Drag Race which are absolutely sublime, and other times I'm just like, oh, boring. So it is going to be a little bit hit and miss. I don't think everything is like finely crafted and honed to perfection. But I thought Ginger Minj and Jujubee were genuinely great as besties. I loved them. I absolutely was hugely invested in the success of their friendship and that they would succeed aboard the Glamazonian Express and displace those mean girl stewardesses who were trying to send them back to Stank Rail.
Jesus Christ.
I was just, you know what? I just had fun with it. So we've given it 3 stars. So, haha, the Empire review agrees with me and not you, James.
Yeah, well, you know how I feel about the Empire reviews this week. So.
I can feel you thinking it's a 2-star from there. I really can.
A 2-star?
1-star for
probably,
James. Yeah.
Probably. But honestly,
I suspect I'd want to burn every copy of this film.
I agree with you, Helen. It's 3 stars for me.
It's fun, right?
I think you've nailed it, that it's loads and loads of gags. It's non-stop sight gags. It's slapstick, it's one-liners, it's very much kind of airplane with drag queens, is like, to be reductive, but that's what it is. And like you said, a lot of it doesn't work, probably 50% does, but that 50% is enough that you're sort of constantly chortling. It looks very cheap and it looks very plastic in places, but that kind of adds to it, to the whole trash aesthetic of it. And I thought Chris Parnell as the captain was wonderful. He's very much doing a Leslie Nielsen straight man, and he's incapacitated by a scorpion, so he can no longer drive the train and the brakes fail and all of this. And there's a running gag, which I really liked in it, that people keep wanting to know what the problem is, and they sort of say, tell it to me straight, and the person sort says what the problem is, and they go, right, great, now tell it to me gay. And then they obviously put on a camp voice to say it again. And stuff like that is very, very silly, but it is in places very funny.
Very funny. There's a Rachel Bloom variation on that gag, which is sublime. Yeah. Absolutely sublime.
And Sarah Michelle Gellar as well, playing a washed-up actress who's kind of hopes people recognise her, but her time has gone, is very, very game of her to do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah, God bless her. So yes, 3 stars for Stop That Train. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by, I think, Dave Green, the director of the fabulous Coyote versus Acme. But it might be Willem Dafoe. I'm not sure. Chris is going to make a call, but he's on holiday. So tune in next week to find out. Suspense. Until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it's goodbye from Jamie.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye from James.
Goodbye. Please listen to the Pilot TV podcast, not least of all because I have Carl Chandler and Aaron Pierre on the podcast on Monday for Lanterns, which, you haven't seen it, is fantastic and is streaming now on HBO Max. I'm not being paid for that plug.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying. And it is also goodbye from me. I'm off to try to cancel my web subscription for the web address mystiqueisnotanxman.com, which apparently is no longer necessary. And thank goodness. Until then, we'll see you again. Bye-bye.